Hello and welcome to One Season Wonders, the show that peers deep into TV's past and brings you the shining treats hidden in the shadows. I'm your co-host Jeff Zuschlag.
And I'm your co-host Mark Zuschlag.
And today we are tackling episode 2 of Kings, the one season biblical retelling show that came on NBC back in 2009, right?
Right, yep, back in 2009.
Yeah, and failed to set the airwaves afire, but did produce some very, very interesting content. Yeah.
Yes, interesting content.
Interesting is a good way of putting
it. So close, but so far.
It tries its very best, and that's what's important. And there are some interesting things to talk about in this episode. It wasn't. It was definitely rougher than the pilot.
Much rougher. Much rougher.
But you know, sophomore slump, man. Season 2's Tuesdays. They're all hard.
It's in a transitory period.
Yes, you know? Exactly. And I also kind of feel for them because it's this weird thing of like they had a whole hour and a half in the pilot, which is almost like two episodes, to like set up a whole bunch of subplots and explore things, and then in this episode they were just kind of like, oh, we got 45 minutes to like wrap up everything like,
right,
we didn't resolve in the pilot, and then also like
introduce
plant
new
seeds
stuff
for new storylines. Yeah, and you sort of feel that tension.
I think you could also see, sort of in contrast to Netflix HBO specials of the modern era, the constraints commercials place on the pacing of the episode itself.
Yes,
there are a lot of sort of strange happenings that don't fit the sort of neat three-act structure that you might want because of the nature of sort of, please stay until the commercials are over.
Right.
Side of business.
Yeah, there were, I mean, this is, you know, a normal thing of TV, but a lot of weird last-minute revelations at the top of scenes,
yes,
of dramatic happenings.
Yes.
But, so we aren't going to go too much in depth with what happened in episode 1, the pilot, because if you want, you can just look at our previous episode to go through that, but kind of the broad strokes are that the story takes place in the kingdom of Shiloh, which is ruled by
kingdom
King Silas.
It's the kingdom of Galboa.
Fuck, you're right.
And the city of Shiloh.
Right.
Were you paying attention, brother? Jesus.
No, absolutely not. As soon as the show gets up, I just tab over to like some fucking ASMR YouTube videos and just let the tingles take me away.
The truth comes out.
Yeah, but it takes place in sort of this alternate modern day retelling of a biblical story.
Right.
And the king of this kingdom and city is King Silas. He's a grumpy dude who is kind of falling out of favor with God. There was a big war with their opponents,
whoa,
the Geth.
Spoilers. The war is still going on.
That's true.
Potential peace at the beginning of this episode.
Right. The pilot ends with our favorite, our golden boy, our hero, David Shepherd, a.k.a. the boy who lived, a.k.a. the golden one, successfully, after the death of his brother, sort of making a very dramatic stand in front of the opposing army and inspiring what promised to be very interesting peace talks.
Yes.
For this war that we kind of know nothing about. They didn't really in the last episode go too deeply into the causes and effects of this conflict, and they still won't, spoiler warning for episode 2.
They hint at it with the port prosperity and the, or port sorrow as it's known by the game.
Yes.
So
they hint at that, and then the other sort of subplot that is thrown up in the first episode that kind of gets a lot of play here is that the king has nefarious dealings with a corporate goon type who threatens to, if the war doesn't continue because he wants to make more bombs and guns and stuff, he will pull money from the treasury, thus supposedly dooming the people of the kingdom, which is,
yes,
we'll go into that.
Suspect.
Yeah, it's a strange economy, I suppose, that relies on this very tenuous relationship, but we'll see how that plays out in this one.
Right.
So let's get to it. Let's get to episode 2. So we open with King Silas on a rooftop. It's raining. It's pouring. The old man is not snoring. He is beseeching the heavens. He's very distraught.
It's sort of a, my God, why have you forsaken me kind of deal.
Yes, it is, except instead of the immortal line, my God, why have you forsaken me, or something similar, he just says, don't go.
Don't go. Well, no, because it's supposed to lead into the brother's line. You know, it's to show the connection between King Silas and our boy David Shepherd.
No, get it. Look, I get the intention. The problem is that, like, if your God, if the metaphysical being tying your world together that crowns you king through divine light is leaving you,
just dips out.
Like, yeah, like, you don't say don't go. That's what you say when, like, you know, your girlfriend is mad at you and about to leave.
God is a harsh mistress, man.
Yeah. Or your last friend is about to walk out of your, like, one man improv show and you really just
speaking
need
from
an
experience,
audience.
Jeff.
No, what? Of course not. I'm very popular.
No, it is a weird line though. Once again, I think it goes into what you said is sort of the part of the subtext, part of the subtitle that's been sort of a big problem with the show is that they're not going deep enough with everything that
yeah.
they do.
So
not if God is leaving you, you don't just say,
wait,
don't go.
Wait, can you wait just a second? Oh my God, you're so like this. Anyway, but what that really is, we actually don't really get in this episode if that's a dream or if that's a future, a flash forward.
Right.
We don't really know.
That,
he just says, don't go.
Point. That's a good point.
Some birds fly across the screen and then we cut to David, who is sleeping in his swanky ass apartment with the big old grand piano, and his brother materializes in
dead
front
brother.
Of him and says, dead brother, the brother
Spoilers.
Who is super dead,
so
bombed
dead.
To shit, dies.
Almost as dead as their father.
Yeah.
He's also very dead.
Yes.
If you were paying attention to the last episode.
And he says the same words to David. He says, don't go. And David is sort of flummoxed by this. He's not quite sure what's going on. And well, that becomes kind of a running motif. We cut to the kingdom, the capital, I guess, building or castle. I don't know what you would call it, but the king's quarters.
Right.
And the queen is sort of giving a impassioned speech leading into the arrival of the Geth delegation. Essentially,
right.
She's like, "We need to make sure." Yeah, yeah. She's like, "We need to make sure this dinner's perfect. Table seatings have decided the course of history and whatnot." And that everything needs to be absolutely tip-top shape because we need this piece so badly. And I guess the Geth are very particular prickly folk. It's politics. It's, you know,
right.
It's the way
yeah.
it is. I like that her character's showing a bit more drive and nuance and resolve than the first episode where she was just looking for her cell phone.
Yeah.
And
dishing
out terrible advice.
I think she's becoming sort of, she has potential to be one of the more interesting characters just because we honestly don't quite know what her motivations are quite yet. I mean, we
yeah.
kind of already see sort of the arc of especially because it's based on the Bible. So, spoiler, the story's already been written
yeah.
down. We can already see a lot of the characters, their sort of arcs, you know, where the show may be taking them. But
yeah.
she's one that's still sort of a little more out there, partly because they haven't really done anything with her in the
right,
past couple episodes,
right.
but this one, I agree, did a better job of fleshing her out.
Yeah, and we get little flashes of that she might have her own agenda,
right?
Kind of even separate from the king, but that kind of gets into later. So part of her preparations are that there are these fucking birds just hanging around the Capitol building,
yes,
driving people crazy, and they're pigeons. I mean, they're not like. It'd be badass if they were fucking yeah. hawks, like,
a
hanging around.
A band of hawks are just
yeah.
or terrorizing like the palace populace.
Yeah, yeah. That would be sick. No, they're just pigeons. They poop on the king's cup, and he's just kind of mildly bemused by that. But these are our two favorite people from the first episode, the two doormen slash guards slash piano movers slash, I guess, like, stand-ins for the working man. Like, they look like they're out of... like an old timey's like 1920s Nickelodeon about cops.
You where, know, like the overly heavy one. He is a shave away from being Paul Blart Mall Cop.
He really is. That's the thing. Is that that's what I was gonna say? Is that you got the like the heavy set one who's like is all bumbling and stuff, and then you got like the skinny one who's always like, nah, I don't know if you should do that. It's like sarcastic. Like they look like a fucking like vaudeville act. Like it's.
Yeah, they have this weird dance number in the middle of the episode that's, you know, with the canes and the piano. Yes. It's bizarre, but we'll get into that later.
Which you might wonder, like, why are we focusing on these two doormen? Oh, we'll tell you. Like, this isn't just us going
pivotal.
Down.
They're pivotal to the plot. And we have a theory.
We aren't just going down, like, the detail rabbit hole, which I know we do. Like, these guys actually do pay off in a way that's my favorite. It redeems the show, I think. But so they're charged with getting these goddamn birds out of this
right.
castle
right.
to keep from pooping on the king's chalice. So they're sort of rallying the troops, both literally and figuratively, for this peace accord. David right. is not invited, and his mom is in town as well, which we find out. And she is kind of trying to get him to come back home because as far as she's concerned, it's a done deal. He's done his time. His brother's dead. His dad's dead. ain't a whole lot of male blood left in the family.
Right,
so.
Right.
So she said, shooting up the signal flare, come home, David. Everyone assembles for the peace talks, and wouldn't you know it, but the goddamn Geth have suddenly decided that got a very particular request the moment, like, the pens are sit before
the
them.
The TV cameras are on them. Yeah, it's just...
You got very upset at this scene.
I just don't... Like, once again, I understand it's part of the dramatic tension. It's just such a... I feel like it's such a symptom of network television, a lot of network television shows in general. And sort of what I was saying about the TV commercial, like, break forcing things. Because I'm pretty sure that happened right before they cut to the intro of the show.
Yeah.
And so they have to have some weird... tension building moment to keep people watching through the episode. It's like they can't trust people to be patient enough to just sit down and watch this TV episode. So that, like, that's not why that doesn't make any sense at all. They wait until that moment to request to have Shepherd, our boy, the boy wonder Shepherd, at the dinner. Like, and then everyone's just okay with it. It's like, oh, this makes sense. Like,
yeah. Yeah, it is kind of a whiplash, and again, mostly for dramatic effect, but it is kind of funny. Actually, this scene is funny for a couple reasons that I forgot to mention. One is when the king and the advisor are walking up to discuss the peace terms, and like simultaneously, as soon as they're ready to sign, the king leans over to his, like, you know, Captain Killjoy, his like general, who the bad military general.
Right.
He leans over to him and is like, "By the way, have a man ready to like assassinate David at any time."
Right.
Because his like political machinations, I guess, aren't in line with ours, or he's like becoming too popular or something.
I think he's just jealous.
I guess so. Yeah, he did. He saw him coordinated by butterflies at the end of the last episode.
Right.
So, like,
right.
I guess you could say he assumes that David is going to supplant him. But it's a very weird thing because he like leans over and is like, make sure you get ready to have the boy taken out. And then leans back. And then the Geth general's like, by the way, wouldn't it be great if suddenly we decided to have the boy show up to this? And the king's like, gulp. Uh-oh.
Ooh, about that.
But yeah, and David sees this live on TV that the Geth are suddenly like, let's have the kid here. He's the one who inspired this process. Like, we're not going to sign until he's here. So David decides he wants to go. His mom's like, don't go. Are you sensing a theme here? Which I didn't really understand because
I'm not picking up with it. I think I need to do it like 100 more times before I can really, really get it.
But she's like, don't go. I don't like peace. I don't want this treaty to be signed, I guess. So stay out of it.
She never really provided a good explanation for him not going. Because, I mean, the alternative is that the war continues. So.
Right. So either she's really savvy, like politically savvy, and, spoiler warning, she knows that this is essentially a ruse. Or she's just, like, doesn't give a fuck about the country, just wants her boy home. Which, I guess, is sympathetic.
It is.
But David's like, no, I gotta do what I gotta do for my country and stuff. So I gotta show up. So David makes an appearance at the dinner, and the king's like, make sure you don't fuck this up for me, kid. Like, or I will have you assassinated. And David's like, what? Nothing.
Actually, right, I'm going to do that anyway. What?
Oh. Yeah. If you see any red dots circling you at the dinner table, just don't worry. It's, you know, it's the light reflecting. It's very, very strange. But they sit down for this big dinner with the Gath delegation. And they're getting the normal thing of like country boy in a fancy setting where he doesn't know the proper silverware placement. And he's very nervous and tense. And the sort of, I guess, general. We don't really know what role he plays in the Gath army. I assume he's like their supreme commander.
Are you talking about the
Bernie Sanders?
Older man, Bernie Sanders. Okay, our boy Bernie Sanders.
Our boy Bernie, who is part
surprisingly,
of the Gath
he had a film career, but you know. Nobody knows this, but
so older general guy who the Geth are kind of like the way they are sort of depicted and the way they speak very elliptically. Again, they never get into super specific details as to what the war is about or who the Geth are or what their philosophy or nation looks like. But they do kind of hint at that this is sort of a like communist military, like they seem very like Soviet Russian is kind of the vibe they're giving off.
They show up in, you know, their general suits while the king and his cohorts are wearing just normal civilian suits, sort of showing the distinction between Gath, the sort of militaristic communist state or whatever you might say, and the civilian more royal looking
the capitalist monarchy.
The capitalist monarchy.
Again, the systems aren't super clear because crazy shit happens.
I don't have time to explain this when other things that don't make sense are happening at the same time.
Right. And part of those things is that the head general challenges David and is like, well, what do you think of this treaty? How does it strike a common soldier like yourself? And I kind of wanted David to just be like, well, I don't know what's in it. Do you know what's in it? Does anyone know what's in it? Like, what is in this treaty? Nobody knows.
See, I was hoping he would say, I actually don't want to see the peace treaty because the greatest things in life are to run down your enemies and see here the lame intentions of their women.
Just go full militaristic.
Yeah, go full.
Say, like,
Conan.
You know, God's on my side, right? Like, you don't want to do this, man.
But alas,
he does not do either. He instead gives a very like charming off the cuff thing of like, well, you know, I'm just a simple soldier, and I was told to keep my mouth shut. So, this treaty is very important to me. My brother died, and my father died, and I don't want any more people
and I
dying.
Don't
want
to die.
Yeah, I don't want to die. I guess I'm next on the chopping block the way this is going. I'd rather not have that happen, so I'm just going to focus on knowing which fork is the right fork. And everyone's very charmed by this.
Everyone's
and
very
King
charmed.
Silas is like, King Silas leans over during the fucking dinner to his general, was like, don't shoot the kid just yet.
As if like it was going to happen in the middle of dinner.
Yeah, in the middle of dinner. He leans over and is like, don't pull the trigger just yet. Like, the kid's okay. The kid gave a good answer. Don't, like, execute him on the spot. Which is crazy.
He has another hour to live.
Yeah, which is crazy because, like, okay, one, like, I guess this is just, like, a standing assassination order that anytime the king can snap his fingers and just take the kid out, which seems crazy. Two, like, whatever problems David can cause for you, I guarantee it'd be way more controversial to have your own soldier assassinated at like a diplomatic dinner with like a bunch of generals. Like, holy shit, what a bad idea that would be. But David gets to live because he says the right things at dinner.
Right.
But who isn't having such a good time is the king's son, Prince Dirtbag, a.k.a. The gay one. Yes, a.k.a. I couldn't not see him as Jared Kushner this episode, which
except he's he looks like Kushner.
He does a little bit.
But he has sort of the opposite persona of Kushner in a sense that he's given very little authority, but spends a good amount of time in the limelight.
That's true. And has a discernible personality.
But he does still have secret dealings with shady characters, future listeners, please tell us how it goes.
That's true. Yeah, we're recording this. This may not go up until everything's terrible or worse, I guess. So let us know how it's going, dear future listeners.
Dear future, if you're still there.
Yeah, but he's pissed because he isn't given a seat at the dinner because they wanted David to be there instead.
They just don't like him. They straight up
they
don't
just
like
don't.
Him.
Honestly, I don't blame them.
He's kind of a prick.
He offered David a suit once. After that, hasn't really done much.
It's been all downhill since the suit offering.
And this typifies that because he goes to, I guess, his like secret group of soldier loyalists, or like people who are in his unit, I suppose.
Yeah, I think so.
And he kind of is like, has this very like secretive hallway meeting where he's like, can you guys believe this bullshit? And I thought this was going to be him setting up a coup, or like planting the seeds for like he's going to be sort of have men on the inside that David should watch his back, or like, you know, something to the effect of like, oh, there's another hint of danger in this city that David needs to watch out for, is that like not only does the king kind of hate him, the prince kind of hates him for entirely separate reasons now.
Right.
And he has loyalists who David may not see.
Right.
But instead what happens is the prince is like, you know what would make us feel better? A shopping montage. Yeah.
This store they go to has it all. It has watches, it has prostitutes, it has cars apparently. This is the Costco of expensive shit, apparently.
Yeah, luxury Costco.
Luxury Costco.
It's so good because he, for one thing, it's very bizarre because, again, we go from secretive, like, Watergate meeting to fucking, like, entourage style, like, we're just, like, throwing watches at each other and, like, we got fancy ties and, like, the fitting ladies will sleep with you, I guess, if you, like, pay them. I don't know. And then he turns to the lady and he's like, do you sell cars here? And it's like, what?
What?
At the suit store? What? But they do.
Apparently,
so
yeah.
Apparently,
yeah.
it's totally a thing.
We actually never hear his answer. So her answer might have been no. And then
That's
he said,
crazy.
You do now.
You do now. I'm going to buy you a car, give it to you, then you're going to sell it to me and I'll buy it again. I'm rich.
I would like to point out, there is still potential that those characters will come back as sort of Watergate type conspirators.
Sure.
Because I think in the previous episode, you know how he meets with the scumbag corporate guy and he's like,
yeah,
you want to be king, right, kid?
Yeah.
And of course he does. So maybe it's going to come back somehow.
Possibly.
But they don't. That's not the impression it gives, despite the setup.
No. No. Instead, it's just a very strange sort of note. And the thing that's kind of important is that they mention the treasury.
Right.
And they're kind of wasting money from the treasury. And we cut, they like, throughout this, we keep cutting back to the doorman trying to get the birds out. And they're trying to hose, they're trying to, like, throw rocks at them. Nothing's working on these birds. And it's
right.
A very touching sort of
interview. You can really feel for the beyond the high politics that really don't apply to us commoners. You know, we can really identify with these two.
Yes.
These two guards. Yeah. Bring us back down to earth.
Yeah, they are the rock that this show is built upon. The anchor.
The anchor.
Of this. And then also during this, like, David and the princess are kind of continuing their lightly flirtatious, like, they're into each other. Nothing really happens until the very end in this. It's just, like, they're into each other.
Right.
David's mom knows that she's into him because they have a small conversation where they both confess to caring about David.
Right.
And then David talks to her about it. And it's just kind of like, no, it's nice. And hopefully it'll go somewhere. And we get to the actual signing of the treaty, supposedly. They do this very interesting kind of, like, which I thought was kind of cool. This sort of like power move of, they have the waitstaff marching like a military. And they do this sort of choreographed dance where they like remove all the chairs and like set up the dining room that was being used to like sign a treaty and like move the table and set up cameras and all that. So it's kind of neat. And they put the pens down and wouldn't you know it, again, the Geth take one look at the treaty. They slap the table and they say, this has been changed.
Right.
And they say they give some detail now, but again, it's detail kind of without meaning. Cause they say like, we were supposed to get 10 more kilometers of
and
the West Bank.
And water rights.
Yeah, yeah.
The West Bank, Jeff. Let's keep things not political here.
Oh, shit. I didn't even mean that was a slip.
On the East Bank.
Yeah,
the East Bank.
Bank. 10 kilometers on the East Bank and water rights. And it's like, okay, I don't know what that really means, but I guess it's about territory. And they storm out, and David, as they're storming out, freaks out and is like, no, don't go.
I would like to interject and point out that at this point there are two sort of Gath general characters. One is Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders.
Who is the more sympathetic one. And the other one
naturally
is this sort of...
Everyone loves Bernie.
Everyone loves Bernie. Of course. And the other one is not Bernie. We'll call him not Bernie Sanders.
Not Bernie Sanders.
Not Bernie Sanders. And yeah. he is a lot more militant. Has been kind of put off by the whole thing this entire time. Has been kind of trying to stall the talks for as long as possible. And he's the one yeah. who actually slams it down and is like, this is unacceptable.
Right, right.
Sort of yeah. thing. He's the antagonist of this series of events.
Yeah, and he hates David's guts.
And he hates David's guts.
So, but David freaks out and grabs Bernie Sanders and is like, don't go, don't go, don't go. You can't do this. This, we're going to go to war again. I hate war. Like, did I tell you about my dead brother and dad? and the general's like, nah, peace. And then the not Bernie Sanders is like,
to look for like the war. You think you can change this?
Yeah.
You're just a small ant, you piece
you're
of
just
shit.
A tiny, you're just a tiny.
I don't care about your
boy.
Dead father or brother.
yeah, so bad news bears for David, and naturally King Klaus is like, it's David's fault. David did it. David's the reason this treaty isn't working.
Wait. I thought King Klaus was like, it's not David's fault.
That comes later, I think. Well, David takes it upon himself that it's like his bad.
David definitely thinks it's his fault.
Yeah. And I thought King Silas gave him a look that was like, fucked up this time, kid.
Okay, then that comes later. Sorry, skipping ahead a little
yes.
bit.
Yes. So David takes it pretty hard that he thinks that he personally fucked up this treaty, which, again, I don't know, it doesn't really track with me. I get that he needs internal conflict, but honestly, like, the treaty was already dead before he grabbed the general. I guess it's like a faux pas and makes things worse, but... we cut to the next
day. It was already pretty bad, considering the two alternatives were war and not war, and it was firmly in the war camp.
Yes.
Things were already pretty low, so I'm not sure David could have... Him not realizing it's not his fault, it's sort of... Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weak subplot, but it's there. Because the very next scene, they have another one of their throne room kind of politics meetings and essentially reveal that, the Geth weren't going to sign the treaty anyway. They just were looking for some excuse to be really just be assholes about it. And they have more demands. They want additional land concessions. And the king's like, nope, can't do that. And he's in a really, really bad place. Not so much in a bad place is our favorite corporate scumbag who is eating a salad very sinisterly.
Very sinisterly.
Yeah, you can tell he's the bad guy.
The dressing is just dripping down his mouth, and he's like,
absolutely.
We'll see how much money we can take.
It's pure decadence. It's pure corporate decadence.
Rich people eat salads, Jeff.
That's
only
true.
Only
the
wealthy can afford the leafy greens.
If he was eating like an all-American hamburger, we'd be like, okay, at least he's just a common people.
He has a bucket of wings that he's just tearing into.
Exactly. If he had,
he's just throwing the bones aside. There's like a little underling catching that. He's kneeled down. He's catching them. Some are hitting his face.
If he was playing a full back of baby back ribs like a harmonica, we would know that at least he's got like some salt of the earth character to him. But no, he's just like nibbling at a goddamn
salad.
Fucking Greek salad. Some romaine, like a creep. And his advisors are essentially like, yeah, the king's in a tough place because war's going to happen again, and nobody kind of likes that. He's having a bad day, and the corporate guy's like, you know what would be funny? If we took all the money out of the treasury, because that's a thing we can do because we can.
It'll also bankrupt the entire economy.
Apparently.
Apparently, because countries don't take out debt ever.
Yeah, this is nuts.
Countries
it's so crazy.
Never borrow money.
Like, okay, so we harped on this a bit in the first episode, but it really must be underscored that the economics and just government systems of this nation make no goddamn sense. Like, not a lick. And on one hand, it's you suspend your disbelief when you watch TV. I know that. Like, you're not supposed to. Anybody can look at a TV show that deals with these sort of, like, political intrigue. Anyone could, like, look at Westeros in Game of Thrones and do, like, a deep dive and figure out that, like, oh... their currency doesn't make any sense, or like there's no way trade would work in a geography.
Inflation would definitely be 2% higher.
Exactly. You can nitpick, but in this show, one corporation is like all the money goes away, and it does, and there's just like no more money. Like we see scenes of like banks are shutting down, and the mom, David's mom, is trying to get her like, sorry, your brother died, like compensation check from the government, and she can't get it. Like, the whole country shuts down because one corporation pulled money.
You know, what I think it is the writer played like Civilization 3 and he was like, yeah, when you run out, when the treasury runs out of money, you can't do anything. You can't do anything.
You gotta station some pikemen on your cities to raise their happiness level. Okay. Meanwhile, Gandhi's building a nuke and he's very upset about this.
You just gotta.
But yeah, so like it just freezes the whole nation, and you would think that, like, I guess if it was a loan, like, do they default on their debt? I don't even know. Again, it's like just trying to think of how one corporation could possibly, like, overnight destroy an entire nation. It's like, how did it get this way?
Yeah.
Like, what agreements and systems did you have in place to not, like, check or have a backup?
And once again, as you're saying, suspension of disbelief is part of watching or consuming, really, any media. Like, that's sort of what you pay into to enjoy the media. But when something is so integral to the plot and the character development, the character interactions, but you lack any sort of context to explaining it, it really just takes you out of the whole show. And the biggest problem with this is that this isn't just some one-off, like, oh, that doesn't make sense. It's like they keep bringing up the fact that this one guy can bankrupt the entire country in, like, 5 minutes, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. It's before he's finished with his salad, the country's economy is in shambles. Like, I don't know. But anyway, fortunately, in the depths of our insanity, we're reunited with our former bedrock, and I'd say still bedrock, in addition to the doorman, which is the Reverend Samuel.
Right, yes. He makes a brief appearance, two brief appearances.
And he's great. As before in the first episode, love the actor, love his character. He sort of rendezvous with David, and David's still feeling really bad about grabbing Bernie Sanders so roughly.
He's an old guy, man.
You're going to break his arm. Like, he's got a lot of fire, but he's like a bunch of matchsticks. Like, flammable, but they'll snap in half if you press them too hard. So just watch yourself. No, but the Reverend meets with him, and David, this is another running theme, is that David sort of tells him about his dream. And it's like, my ghost brother said, don't go. I was wondering what that meant. I thought it meant don't leave the city, but actually it means don't go to the dinner. You're gonna fuck it up, you dumbass. And the Reverend Samuel's like, you know, and this is like our sort of sprinkling of religion and God into this episode, is that the Reverend's like, you know, being a reverend, I often look and read signs. And I believe that that is an important thing for people to do, is to look at the signs and what they tell you to do and where they point you. And that's God trying to speak to you. So, you know, read those signs, boy.
This guy knows something. This guy is sort of in the background going to lead Shepherd to whatever, you know, they keep hinting at, like, a destiny or whatever.
Yes.
This guy's the big deal. And this reverend is the only one who's pretty much helping Shepherd in any of this besides the
girl.
But
yeah.
He's the only one who's got Shepherd's back, really, in sort of a very roundabout religious leader prophet-y way.
He's kind of like, he's not quite as ubiquitous as the Greek chorus, but he is kind of like the moral center.
Yeah.
Yeah. He like pops in and like sprinkles some wisdom and then leaves.
Right.
Which is cool. I like that. That's kind of a neat character to have around.
Especially for the context of the story. Especially if they were to push the religious nature of it more, but
yes,
that's a great for the previous episode.
right and that's something the king mentions too, is like reading signs. So the king, with the economy all in shambles because one dude got his panties in a wad, the king decides to go to what I think is actually the most effective scene in the episode, to a point.
Yes.
It's like 80% of it is very good, which is the king goes to this like secret dungeon that houses one dude who's like doing translation work, very like Silence of the Lambs, like he's kept in like shadow, and the king shows up, and it's this very creepy tense scene where the prison reveals that earlier we had heard that the king makes mention of like, a rival used to tell me, when you're king you never sleep, and I had him executed. And the king arrives, and this mysterious prisoner is like, you know, you never sleep when you're king. And we're like, oh shit,
it's the guy.
He's not dead. Yeah, this king that they talked about, this rival king, is still alive, and he's in this prison cell, and he's doing creepy translation work and talking about how he sees like black squids of sin hanging over people. The actor who's playing the king is not that intimidating, which I'm a little upset about. Like, yeah. When he's cast in shadow, his voice is really good for it, and he sounds really creepy, and that's sort of like... It's tropey, but it's good. That's sort of like unhinged, where it's like maybe he's the most sane person
right,
in the room.
Right. Do.
Yeah. Definitely. Like if Anthony Hopkins played this role, it's that role.
This scene just goes to show, like, I think it's a good microcosm of sort of the good things and bad things of the show as a whole. It's like they have this great setup of like, oh, it's the king that was sort of like mentioned, sort of. You know, sort of as like a throwaway line almost, when it's brought back and it has this creepy lighting and the actor has a good voice. But then it's just, as you're saying, it's like 80% good. It's like a B minus. It's almost there.
Yeah.
Almost there. It's so close. But ultimately.
Yeah. But ultimately, the guy who's playing isn't super intimidating. He's like I mean, no offense to him, but he's just kind of like a run of the mill. He looks like he works at like the Meyer down the street. He's got like a goatee. And he's wearing, like, you know, a collared shirt. And
right.
Kind of like, meh. And the king reveals that he knows that this prisoner has a secret stash of gold from when this prisoner was once king of, like, a rival nation, I guess. And although King Silas took over that rival nation, he never discovered where that gold went. Where, I guess, the other treasury went. And he wants this prisoner to give it up. And the prisoner is being very evasive and you know, plotting. And is like, no, well, you know, you've had me in this for 30 years, this hole for 30 years, and I haven't cracked. Like, why would I tell you now?
You can't kill me.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have the balls.
And it's kind of a nice back and forth. And it's nice to see, I don't know. He kind of brings a different energy to the show. And I would have, again, if this show was like more invested in its sort of like supernatural reality and kind of like, I don't know, had a sense of foreboding to it, because like it's the Old Testament God they're dealing with. Like the Old Testament God was fucking like metal. And like terrifying and weird and inscrutable. And so like if they had more of that flavor, like that'd be when he starts talking about like black squids of sin.
Seeing
I'd be
sin,
more like,
yeah.
Ooh. Like this is interesting, because maybe he does see demons. I don't know, like there's a little bit of that there, and I just wish they brought that out. But the king does finally find a way to get this guy to talk.
He has they never show the photos of it, so we're not sure, but apparently he has or knows someone who is close to the former king that that the king thought he killed, but apparently has not killed. So that's sort of this is introducing another subplot.
Yes.
In case there weren't enough, they're definitely going for the Game of Thrones. There's no main character kind of feel to the show. Despite Golden Boy, they're still focusing pretty heavily on these subplots. And I'm actually kind of curious, honestly.
Yeah,
a little bit. More so than some of the other subplots, like buying watches and prostitutes at a store.
The king withholds like the rest of the photo that shows the rest of the survivors from the prisoner's old kingdom.
Right.
But it's an effective scene still. And even though the prisoner folds really quickly as soon as that first like half, I would have loved to like have a little more tension of like he pretends not to break, but then when the king like starts to put away the other half of the photo,
right.
Like you see a bit in his eyes that like he's gonna. But no, like the moment he sees that photo, he's like he goes from like when you walked in here, I sensed a shadow on your back, to being like, "What? She's alive?
Oh my god! Please, king, I'll do anything."
Yeah, it's pretty instantaneous.
Yeah.
Just as instantaneously, the treasury's fixed, apparently. Like, what the fuck? The very next scene is the corporate guy going, "How did he do it? The banks are back."
The gold was under King Silas's pillow the whole time. The last place he would look.
Yes, I hope that was it. It's like, have you checked your pants? Have you checked between the sofa cushions? And it's like, oh my god. The treasury was there.
That wardrobe is not full of clothing.
What? What? You left it in your pocket when you did the wash. It's like, oh my god. So instantly all the banks have the money again.
Instantly.
Somehow. And the brother, the not brother, the brother-in-law corporate scumbag is very flummoxed by this, and he's right. very upset. He's like, where the hell did he get that gold? And which again, fucking just thinking of how much money it takes to run a nation, I guess he just like wired trillions of dollars instantly yeah. to like, it's crazy. But the queen shows up again to sort of put an end to this madness and talks to the corporate scumbag and is like,
her brother.
Hey, yeah, the corporate scumbag, who is her brother? And she's like, don't pull this shit. It's tiring. And this is, again, where we sort of get a flash that she may have separate machinations, because she's sort of like, the king does his bullshit, you do your bullshit. Like, yeah. I'm not really invested either way. I just need you two to stop causing so much chaos. Right. Which I hope isn't just like that she's a home caretaker and she just cares about the sanctity of the home, because that could be a way they take it, is that she's obsessed with like image. I hope it's that she has like her own game that she's playing and that she just really needs these assholes to stop being such assholes.
Right, right. I hope so too, but I'm also not confident that they would be able to pull it off, even if that's the direction they took her in. But it still is an interesting development. It still yes. is a good, it's a positive development, considering a lot of the other developments that happened in this episode weren't yeah. as intriguing, weren't as yeah. sort of game-changing, I guess.
I also just think, like, this is something that we're kind of getting to, and I think is kind of our general takeaway from this episode. There are way too many subplots in this episode.
Yes, definitely.
Like, and the fact that they bring them up and resolve them, like, instantly, it makes it even weirder. The fact that they could have taken a whole episode to do this treasury crisis and right. do it right. Like, actually let things build up, and, like, there's a warning that money is starting to be withdrawn, and it's like, oh, we need to set this up, and we get a bit more details as to like how all these systems interact so that it's more interesting when people are manipulating them. But instead it's like, the money's gone, I found secret money, the money's back, it's all okay now. And it's like, what do we get outside of like the one cool scene in the dungeon? I do not know anything more about this world. I don't right. know more about King Silas. I don't know more about the corporate Definitely. scumbag. I know a little bit more about the queen, but the insanity that they had to precipitate to make these very small plot moves is bizarre to me.
It's so yeah, I don't understand. They could have also spent two episodes, one episode on the peace agreement, one episode on
yeah
the money.
That's right, the peace still don't. Hasn't been signed. Yeah. It's still not, the war is still hovering over all this.
Which also makes the treasury thing even more inexcusable, because it's not like they did sort of a hand waving where like the treasury is fixed and they don't really say the timeline. No, yeah. it's like there's a problem with the treasury. The king goes, talk to this guy, comes back from talking to the guy. The money is found somehow yeah. wired to like every bank apparently in the country, so that the money is suddenly back. And this is all before the delegates, who said that they would wait for like 2 or 3 hours or whatever before the delegates
right.
of Gath leave. This happened.
They haven't even left yet. They haven't even left the
they're
city.
They're still in the city, like. Like it's like this episode, it's not even like it literally happens in the time span of the episode, like 20 minutes it takes him for him to drive to the place, 5 minute conversation, 20 minutes back, the money is back, the economy is fixed.
Yeah.
Like it's over.
Can you imagine doing business in this world? Like, you just run like a Radio Shack in like the capital city, and you're like, well, I was gonna place an order for more TVs this evening, but you know, 20 minutes ago, the corporate guy choked on a crouton, and now all the money's gone. Oh, wait, fresh update. They did the Heimlich. The money's back. Like, oh, my God. Like, this is terrifying. The seesaws this market must do.
This is truly a much darker place than they were letting on at the beginning of the show.
Truly, the shadows are lengthening over the kingdom. But, yeah, so that's resolved.
We did it.
The economy's good again. And David's on his way out. He's still sad about not seeing the signs in time. He's going with his mother. He's on his way out of the city. King Silas, now that he's done fixing the economy, decides, you know what? I should have a talk to my daughter about this David boy.
David boy.
And alludes that she took... Is she a nun? Your theory is that she's a nun.
I honestly don't remember. I do remember, because I watched this, you know, sorry to break the magic of the podcast, but I did watch this back when this first came out, so 7 years ago.
Yeah.
So I don't remember most of it. I do remember some later scenes where, well, I don't really want to spoil it, so I won't spoil
it. Yeah.
Okay. But I don't remember the exact nature of her vow. So I feel like we can still take this bet, unless I subconsciously remember it.
Yeah.
But we have two competing theories. I think both are equally valid.
Yeah.
My personal theory is that she is a nun, or some kind of has promised not to remain celibate in some way to pursue her own agenda, her own goals for whatever reason. Or it might be bringing back sort of the God aspect of the world.
Yeah. And my theory initially was her vow was a marriage vow to some other prince or something, which would make sense. But I'm kind of going back on that because why would
don't chicken out now?
Yeah, like no, because I think like the king in the very first episode lets David dance with his daughter, and it like kind of alludes to like, no, you want my daughter, my princess, huh? So like it seems weird to me that he wouldn't just be like, bro, she's got like a husband,
right?
In it coming. So I think it is probably some sort of holy vow of celibacy. But the point is that like he reminds her like, yo, you can't be jumping on that golden boy.
Although in defense of your theory, this show has proven time and time again that they're willing to withhold crucial and or just general context for anything in order to make a dramatic point.
That's
since
true.
The first
That's
scene
true.
Where the guy runs in and is like, sir, there's been a problem with the Geth, and the king goes on this huge speech and he's like, it's your son.
Yeah, yeah, that's
the
true.
The show is
yeah.
not beyond just not telling people things just for the sake of not telling people things.
Right, right.
So.
Ugh. Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows?
But yeah, so she can't be with David is kind of the upshot, is that their sweet little tete-a-tete, yet another subplot, is now taking a turn for the worse. So everyone's secret backstory is just coming out in this episode. Everyone's got a past that needs to be expounded upon.
That's actually... one more thing. Although I did like the general tone and the general outcome and the one subplot of the crazy guy in the former king in the prison.
Yeah.
The one thing the show does, which I'm sort of getting annoyed with, is that pretty much anybody can be bribed because they have some secret loved one somewhere.
That's
like the
true.
King has a secret son, the brother-in-law, the reason why he sort of steps in line is because he apparently has a secret son who was kicked out of the court at some point. The king, the former king, has a secret relation somehow.
That's
like
right.
All these characters have secret family. Like, how do so many people have secret families?
That was the working title of the show. Like, hey guys, hear me out. I've got this show. Okay, it's called Secret Family.
It's like if in Game of Thrones. It just starts off with Ned Stark, and we know nothing about him. It's just Ned Stark. And then the king is like, oh, you won't come to King's Landing? Well, what if... And then he just pulls out like a painting of one of his sons, and he's like, yeah. Well, what would you tell your son? And he's
oh
like,
my God.
Right.
You're right. I forgot. They pull that move so many times that like somebody's not going to budge, and they're like, well, what about your like inserts family, estranged family member here? And then instantly they're like, oh, this is so... Yeah, even the corporate scumbag. I forgot the corporate scumbag has a secret son who was banished from the court, and now the queen is like, hey, we could invite him back. And it's like, oh, all right.
Well, that was fixed.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a common device. It just completely flew from my mind. But yeah.
Listeners, be careful about your secret family. They may come back to bite you if you have machinations.
That bastard son or estranged daughter... could be used against you.
Could be, so watch out.
So live like a hermit and or eat your family. Or both.
Why not?
Yeah. So next, though, we get... All right, so this is kind of into the final sequence of the episode. And it is both...
The climax.
Yes, the climax of the episode. And this is both the best and... dumbest scene back
just,
to back.
Really just the best
in
both ways.
Yeah, okay. So David is in a taxi. Like we need to like stretch this out entirely before we... Yeah,
this
before
is
we
when
out.
We will get to the nitty gritty because this
yeah,
is,
I want,
this
I
is
want
fantastic.
The nitty gritty. I want the nitty gritty of this sequence because it's so good. David is in a cab with his mom and they're heading back to leave the city because David doesn't belong there. He's just going to get used. Yada, yada, yada. I fucked up. I feel bad feelings. But as he's leaving, he notices, he looks out the window, and there's a very small protest A very small, non-specific.
It's on the TV. It's we're getting nitty gritty. It's on the TV of. This makes it even better.
Oh, that's
actually.
Right. That's right.
This is on
right.
the TV in the taxi.
In the taxi, they're live at where the delegation is about to leave, and there's a very small, non-specific protest going on about the delegation. You know it's small, non-specific because the only sign in the protest is the sign being held up by a small child that just says, "Don't go."
Don't go.
Which, oh my God, when they said reading the signs and then literally made a kid hold up a sign.
So we need to go back a little bit, Jeff. We forgot the scene where David is just back at his farm and he's just beating this horse, just mercilessly beating this horse, just with a baseball bat, with a club,
and the horse is dead. The horse is dead. That's the thing. But he won't
so
stop beating
dead.
It.
He just won't stop beating
won't
it.
Won't stop beating this horse.
I'm not so sure what that scene was about, but I want to put everything in context. So sorry to interrupt. Continue.
No, but he sees literally the sign, and he literally reads the sign, which has a crucifix as a T. It's a nice touch.
Oh my God.
And he's like, "Oh, I shouldn't go. This is God telling me not to go."
Yes.
And so what he does is he says, "Stop the cab." They stop the cab. He gets out, goes to the driver's seat, throws the cabbie out, is like, I'm stealing your car. Mom, get out. You're walking. Jumps in the taxi, and the taxi cab guy's noticeably upset about this.
That is going to be the most awkward conversation between the taxi cab driver and the mother.
The mother just like, "That's your son? You raise him that way?" And she's like, "Well, his dad died for this. So
for this city. You know.
For the
dad died for your job, so."
Yeah, exactly. And David takes the cab and drives it. And this is kind of a cool sequence. He drives it to where the delegation's going and like rams it right where their cars are going. So he gets rammed in the cab.
T-boned.
And just like the entire place just goes crazy. And like soldiers come out of everywhere for like both sides.
Right.
They're pointing guns. Like this is one part where like the budget didn't really get in the way because there were like plenty of extras on hand in the background too to like
Definitely.
Really sell that like this crazy standoff just happens in an instant and people are like trying to cover VIPs and David gets out and everyone's pointing guns at each other and it's this really tense standoff. And then finally the king shows up and says, "Don't shoot. Let's figure this out." And he takes Bernie Sanders aside.
And he's like, "What do you want, Bernie Sanders?" And Bernie Sanders is like, "Free universal healthcare.
Universal healthcare. College for everyone." No, what he actually says is, "Look, you guys blew up a tank and it humiliated us because we're sort of a militaristic society and that's all we have. We want your profits. We want your glorious capitalism, essentially. Like, we want your luxuries. We want your city."
This is some Glasnost type shit he's laying
in
front of King Silas.
Yeah. But we can't have that, so gotta do a war. And King Silas is like, "I have a great idea." And this is when the scene turns dumb again.
Once again, this totally backs up my claim for the idea that civilization, this guy just played the game Civilization and based the entire politics behind it.
That's how his forefathers trained him to be king. It's like, "We set you down with a PC and a copy of Civilization 3.
And have at it. Because
and you're going to learn everything you need to know about economy and military.
So you have this treasury that has a lot of money in it. And if you don't have any money, you can't buy things.
Can't do it.
You can't do it.
But yeah, so he says, "I have a great idea. The reason that we are so profitable is because when we were first making this city, we took this port called Port Prosperity from you. And it's a trade center and it's done great for us. What if we gave it back to you and you can just make your own damn economy? How about that?"
I think you stop bitching all the time to
us. Yeah, why don't you fucking try it if it's so easy? And Bernie Sanders is like, "Really? A whole? We were just asking for 10 kilometers near the East Bank or whatever, but you want to give us like essentially Manhattan? Okay, yeah, totally. We'll take that, I guess." Like,
hell yeah.
So, what?
I believe his exact quote was, "Hell yeah."
Yeah, it was
exactly
hell
what he said.
Yeah, King Silas,
my man,
my man. Now we're talking. But yeah, so apparently that clears it up. It seems insane to me that they can just give away a whole city. I don't
know
how
civilization,
that...
Civilization. Have you ever played the game?
Apparently,
pick a city. Just give it away. Just give it away.
Apparently, I need to play more to understand this system. God, this poor, again, like the poor Radio Shack guy who's just like, oh fuck, finally, thank God they got the crouton out of the corporate guy's mouth. The banks are back online again, and then. What, they're going to do what to the city?
Yeah. Suddenly, I'm a Gathian.
Yeah, I'm not a citizen. Oh, okay. I guess you can just do that. So, yeah, the weirdest, dumbest peace accord, but it works out. They shake hands on it. They go back. They sign the peace treaty. It's all good. David feels very fulfilled that he finally made things right.
Yes.
And we're like, surely this wraps up all the plots. But then,
surely.
But then, the king is like, "Oh yeah. By the way, Corporal Killjoy, we probably shouldn't have David assassinated anymore because."
Oh right.
Because yes. He did good things, and the corporal's like, "Our assassin's not picking up the phone."
His rank has been changing throughout this entire episode. First, he's a general. He's a captain. Now he's just a corporal who's in charge of assassination plots. It's kind of bizarre. But
I don't
anyway.
Know, man. They give him a name. They never refer to him by it.
He just looks angry all the time. I don't think he's changed his facial expression this entire show.
Yes.
He has one job. Just
yes.
Look angry and
look
kill
mad and,
Shepard.
Yeah, and kill David Shepard
with his own two hands.
But he's like, "Our assassin's not picking up the phone." Oh shit!
literally has gone radio silent. He's got his phone on silent mode. He just doesn't hear the text message coming.
He was seeing a movie before he set up his sniper position, and you know he turned it off.
Yeah, no,
he forgot. And I kept sending him too many texts in the middle of the night, just being like, "You up?"
That actually would have been fantastic. Really would have added depth to the general's character if he was he's not picking up he's not answering his phone. Why not? I may have called him like a bunch of times last night.
Yeah.
To see if we could get back together.
I
know
have
I made
any
some
friends.
Mistakes, but
I don't have many friends around the military. Like, so when I get a personal assassin that I can just command, like I like to, you know, bond a little bit. Like maybe there's something there. And I guess I texted him the eggplant emoji one too many times in the middle of a mission, and he just put his phone on silent. So
I guess Shepard's gonna die.
Yeah, I guess he's a dead kid. So anyway. So Shepard is in the middle of the cobblestone street like a dumbass, just asking to be picked off by a sniper. But then we cut back to
the heroes clad in black and, well, mostly just black, but
yeah,
our boys with the pigeons.
Yes, our vaudeville angels, who decide that the best course of action at this point, which again, I guess they've been at this for days because, like, not too much time has passed, time.
No. They're not. You've lost track of the timeline, but I'm here to keep track for you.
Okay.
At lunch, they eat lunch, and the Gath refuse to sign the treaty. 20 minutes later, the king fixes the treasury, and 2 hours later, the Gath
leave. That can't
be
it. Okay, so this is the insane scenario we've walked into. Either A, that all of this happened within 20 minutes, which means that the kingdom was starving and then rejuvenated within like less than an hour. Or these doormen have been trying to get rid of these birds for several days at the very least.
Whichever one makes more sense, we'll let you decide.
Yeah, take your pick, audience. But so they finally decide we're going to throw a hand grenade at the birds. Which they totally do. The skinnier guy is like, "Is that a grenade?" And the Paul Blart is like, "You betcha." And he throws it in to like where the birds are making their nest, and it explodes.
There's blood everywhere. It's awful.
Horrific.
I can't believe they allowed this on network television.
No, it works, weirdly enough. And the birds scatter and they leave. And as David is like, he's like a glistening holiday ham ready to be picked off.
Yes.
The birds fly in front of the sniper's scope, and the sniper shoots with a very like GoldenEye 64 like shooting effect.
Yes.
Just
yes.
Pew, pew. And hits a bird instead of David. And David is saved. So in a way, the doormen like really are the heroes. They just like saved the kingdom.
As you were saying, right after we finished watching it, they're definitely going to be just straight up angels. It's going to be like the Christmas special, Miracle on 34th Street or whatever.
Yes. Oh my God.
It's like, I'm your guardian angel. Let's see what would have happened if you hadn't existed.
Wait, no, that's
a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, Jesus. Miracle, it's a Wonderful Life.
Miracle on 34th Street. I thought you were going to be like, it turns out one of them is Santa Claus. and they have a big trial.
We don't know. Paul, maybe it'll jump forward 30 years later and Paul Blart has a massive white beard.
Yes, I hope so. But yeah, they're definitely, I hope we see more of these doormen because they're the best.
They are the best.
But they avert the assassination attempt. Like after the shot is hit by the birds, another, I guess, government agent shows up at the assassin's side and is like, dude, Don't kill him. It's been called off.
Also, so check David your gets, messages.
Check your messages. Delete all the sects, and you'll see that the assassination is called off.
Right.
And so David lives, and he's got a bright future ahead of him. He stares at a dead bird on the sidewalk, and is like, "That's weird." But he survives to fight another day. So.
And that's how the episode closes out. Him being saved by an act of God or an act of two heroes. Hand grenade wielding heroes.
Yeah. So I guess we could add to their job description, like doormen, guards, piano moving people, and terrorists, I guess.
Terrorists, yeah. Pigeon terrorists.
Yeah.
Maybe this become a recurring thing. They terrorize a different bird each episode.
Oh God, I wish. I wish this was a running joke.
Every episode ends with a dead bird. Somehow.
The dead bird somewhere.
Somewhere.
Michael, I've been reading the drafts of your script, and it's all right. Got some notes. Why does every episode end with a dead bird? Because fuck birds. That's why, Jeremy. Fuck birds.
Have you ever seen the movie Birdemic? We're not going to allow that to happen.
It's a revelation. So that's the second episode, and it's not great.
It's not great. It's not looking
terrible.
Good. It's not looking good, listeners.
Yeah, there are like again moments of like, oh, this is a cool scene, or this scene has cool elements in it. But this episode was just so many subplots and so many like key details get glossed over while we get into like. Bogged down in giant plot maneuvers that make nothing. Like a lot of TV, like Game of Thrones, gets accused of like every episode the plot moves like very slightly, but at least like you're just moving pieces on the chessboard around, waiting for like something to finally happen. But at least like a lot of those scenes in Game of Thrones and other slower paced shows like are interesting. They find ways of matching up characters and matching up scenarios that we get like the texture of their relationships and we kind of get a sense for. All the details that make characters and scenarios unique and make them really stand out and feel real so that when something does happen, we're like, oh shit, because we know how much it means. In this, tons of stuff happens in like less than a week's time span.
Yes.
And most of it doesn't matter and doesn't reveal very much about the characters we don't already know.
Right.
It's just like crazy swings of the pendulum to like, essentially neutralize a bunch of subplots so that we can resolve the peace talks finally and then like move on from there. I don't know. It just felt like a whole lot of.
It lacks direction in a weird way.
Yeah.
Despite all these subplots that are happening, none of them led to anywhere. As you were saying, like sort of the point of subplots is to reveal things about characters and their relationships that eventually lead to some payoff. But these like there are subplots introduced and solved within like. The episode itself or like within a commercial break. I think sort of going back to the example Game of Thrones, because this show feels like it's trying to be a sort of Game of Thrones before it was Game of Thrones. The other thing that Game of Thrones sort of has going for it is along with just subplots within episodes, the subplots that stretch for the duration of a season, they have this great formula where they always sort of introduce the subplots that are going to happen episode 1, episode 2. Then they develop the subplots, and then episode 9 is always this big, huge payoff. It's always the climax of whatever the season was sort of about. And they could have... I mean, maybe they just weren't confident in the series enough, or maybe it just wasn't good writing, or network, blah, blah, blah. We obviously can't Judge the Reason, but for whatever reason, they just didn't have like the balls to do that with the show. I mean, they could have stretched out the Treasury subplot. They could have stretched out the TV sub, the Peace Talk subplots. Those could have been what like the whole series was about, essentially. Yeah. And then just have all these characters interact with those subplots and then have some final big payoff at the 9th or 10th episode. But instead, right. It's done. It's over.
Yeah.
It's finished. And yeah. Just wait until next week for the next one. There's nothing like... It compounds the problems with the context, with the sort of background of the subplots, like with the Treasury thing not making sense. Because they don't explain... They don't use our suspension of disbelief to build something off of it. They just have our suspension of disbelief and then make us suspended even further so they can finish it. It's just... It's not how it can work.
Yeah. And the things we do learn about the characters are often like, oh, they have another secret.
Right, right, yeah, exactly. They have another son.
Who we haven't
seen. Right.
But again, there's like still moments. There are moments that like keep me intrigued. And like, you know, I mean, obviously we're going to keep watching the season because that's what our podcast does. But I do like want to see where this goes because there are like little flashes of like, oh, here's an interesting scenario that you don't usually have because most shows don't have a developed theology motivating character action
directly. There's still a lot of hope for several of the characters to be fleshed out in an interesting way.
Yeah.
That sort of make me want to keep watching it. Like the king, like the other king sort of locked away, the wife, the prophet, the Samuel, is his name Samuel?
Yeah.
Samuel. All right, it's from the Reverend is fantastic. I want to see more of him.
And they keep again like giving these little details. Like one of the details with the imprisoned king was like the reason that he was deposed was that he like King Silas is like maybe you shouldn't have killed so many people.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, absolutely. And it's like, oh shit, is this like they have like Old Testament, Old World, medieval style like.
Retribution, yeah,
like wow. I mean, I guess like in real life we have like crazy dictators too and stuff like that. But like, this seems more like, what if Justin Trudeau decided to like publicly execute his like his family rivals? Like,
right, crazy. Well, I mean, also it's sort of like it's the first. Honestly, it's one of the first interesting pieces of information we have about the world, like at all. Is that not only was he known as this bloody king, but that his people asked for King Silas to come and like take over the country,
exactly.
Basically,
yeah.
Which is very medieval, like sort of like, look, we don't care if it's another king that's taking us over, but like this guy is just straight up murdering us, so please, come save us.
Which I guess this is a world where you give out trade cities, like
that's
you know,
true, like
apology
candy.
Notes,
yeah.
So. Whatever, people are just used to flying. They got all the flags in the closet. Just whoever owns them this year, fly that flag, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, not a great episode, but not the worst episode of TV I've ever seen. And there's still flashes of a unique.
You can see what they're going for as well.
Yeah,
they have all the pieces are there. They're just sort of hot glued together at the moment in whatever fashion they can be.
Yeah.
Fit into.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, I'd like to see more of the Crown Prince, his character fleshed out. Because, as you said before, the one nice thing he did was offer a suit. And the rest of the time, he's just been a colossal, like, douchebag.
Yeah.
Like, he's done nothing else beyond that.
Yeah. And he's a douche other people are mean to, but that doesn't necessarily make him, like, interesting or fun to watch. It just makes him like, okay, I'm slightly more sympathetic to him, but he's still an asshole.
Yeah.
Who buys cars at Men's Warehouse or whatever. So I don't
know. When you're the prince, apparently you have a credit card hooked up to
directly to the
treasury.
Oh my God. It's so dumb. Anyway, so that concludes episode 2 of Kings.
Right.
Next episode, we'll be doing episode 3.
Episode 3.
As before, we are probably going to open up a listener mail segment if people are interested.
Sorry.
Before
we close out, I do want to point out it may be listed as episode 4 because the first was technically two episodes put together. It's sort of how they list it, even though it was one episode.
Okay. So if you're watching along with us, it'll be episode four.
It'll be episode four. It is the third episode titled episode 4.
Yes. The next episode in the series, we'll be watching next time. And our Gmail that you can send mail to is oneseasonwonders@gmail.com. That's one, like the number, numeral one, and then spell that seasonwonders@gmail.com. I don't know when we'll actually be getting to that mail because here's a little peek behind the podcasting curtain. We're recording a bunch of these episodes up front, and then we're going to be kind of releasing them later after we debut. So we might not actually get around to reading this mail until later, but we'll keep in touch. Send us any impressions or whatever if you want. And we'll also have a Twitter and Facebook that you can find and that we'll link to in the description. So, yeah, thanks for joining us on this wild ride. And hopefully we'll see it through to its glorious conclusion.
To its glorious end.
Yes. All right. Cool. So this has been One Season Wonders. I am Jeff Zuschlag.
I'm Mark Zuschlag.
And we are out.
Bye-bye.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?